From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. I was 18 years old when I had my first encounter with bioluminescence. I was serving on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific Ocean, and we were, I think, not far east of Hawaii when I snuck onto the fantail late on a moonless night. Behind the ship for miles was a soft blue glow. And I did understand what I was looking at. I'd heard stories of pilots finding their way back to their carriers by using these natural clues, which are caused by the agitation of bioluminescent organisms, primarily plankton, in the water. When a ship moves through the water, it disturbs these little tiny life forms and triggers a chemical reaction that produces light. But understanding what causes something and appreciating it for yourself are two very different things. And I was not at all prepared for how it made me feel. I was absolutely stunned. In their new book, The Radiant Sea, Color and Light in the Underwater World, Stephen Haddock and Sonka Johnson explore the myriad creatures that create light underwater. And that's not just the plankton that created the light show that I witnessed behind my ship. It also includes jellyfish and coral, shrimp and sharks, squid, lanternfish, anglerfish, sea fireflies, and fireworms. They use light for defense, for luring food, for attracting mates, and for communication. But capturing these creatures in photographs remains hard. Haddock and Johnson sought to overcome that challenge. They spent years tracking down bioluminescent creatures in the deep ocean. And while they were at it, they created beautiful photographs of animals that play with light in other ways, through transparency and pigmentation, iridescence and fluorescence. Sonka Johnson first trained in math and art and has studied light in nature for more than 30 years, most recently at Duke University. His field work primarily involves open ocean research cruises that use scuba and deep sea submersibles. Sonka Johnson, welcome.
Thank you.
And Stephen Haddock studies marine diversity, molecular biology, and bioluminescence at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute and the University of California, Santa Cruz. Documenting creatures in the deep sea and capturing them in their luminescent displays, many for the first time, his aim is to increase an appreciation and understanding of the ocean's inhabitants. And his imagery and research have been featured in National Geographic, the New York Times, and in documentaries on the BBC. Stephen Haddock, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Stephen, let me start with you today. Can you tell me about your very first dive?
Yeah. So I grew up not far from the ocean. And we would, every summer, my friend and I would get on the bus and go down to the beach almost every day that we could get away from our chores. And so we quickly just became, you know, snorkelers. This was down in Southern California, exploring all the corners and angles of this reef. And then I got scuba certified when I was 13. So our bus trips would turn out to be kind of a spectacle with us lugging our tanks and all of our heavy gear onto the bus with all these elderly people kind of staring at us. But we would go down to the beach and lug our gear down the stairs and go diving. I've been doing it for a while now, and fortunately have been able to keep doing it as part of my daily job.
Sonka, where did you grow up?
Quite differently from Steve, I grew up a long way from the ocean in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where all the steel mills are, and it's about a day and a half from the ocean.
Okay, so you're an inland guy. How did you get connected so deeply to the ocean?
It was an escape at first. Pittsburgh at that time in the 70s and 80s was probably about the most non-natural place to be, being nothing but steel and asphalt and giant slag piles and so on. And so for 2 weeks every year, we would escape to the beach in North Carolina on the Outer Banks near Kill Devil Hills and Nag's Head. And for me, that was my first introduction to nature of any kind. And it made just this powerful impression on me since I was, you know, just a few years old.
And when did you get to diving?
Scuba diving later than Steve, because again, I was a long way away from being able to do it, you know, except let's say in the Monongahela River, which is opaque.
It's gotten better, hasn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, now it's semi-opaque. Yeah, it's still, you could walk across it if you really tried. But yeah, I learned to scuba dive early in graduate school at the University of North Carolina. I took a typical course, and I remember we finally got to do our checkout dives, which were off of West Palm Beach, which has these coral reefs. And, you know, of course, I'd seen pictures of coral reefs and read about them, but was just absolutely gobsmacked and astonished when I finally got to go into the water and dive in that habitat. I mean, for me, it was a world that I never wanted to leave again. And I spent as much time as possible during graduate school and afterwards underwater in different places.
When you dive, something happens to color as you descend deeper and deeper into the ocean. Stephen, can you describe that experience?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of the nature documentaries and stuff that you see, everything looks brightly colored because they brought their own lights down there to help illuminate things for you. But when you're scuba diving, and especially off the California coast, not so much in the tropics, the light really quickly within, you know, 10, 15, 20 feet will start to just become uniformly blue or green. And so your perspective on that habitat really, it really changes when you are immersed in the environment and seeing it, how the animals see it. One kind of interesting thing, I was doing a scuba dive here off Monterey, and it was a pretty deep dive on the edge of the canyon. So we were at about 100 feet, and there were some anemones on the rocks. And even at that depth, with just dim blue light coming down, the anemones looked red. So I immediately knew that they were doing something tricky with the light and converting the blue photons into red photons via fluorescence. So we collected some of them, and we ended up cloning the proteins that they used to convert that light. But yeah, just trying to like keep your eyes open to see how are organisms adapting. It's really transformative.
When you dive as a recreationalist and when you dive as a scientist, your brain is doing a couple of different things, right?
Yeah. I think any time that we are interacting with nature, we're kind of like nascent scientists inside a little bit. So my first official scientific publication was based on an observation that I made as a teenager scuba diving in these Southern California beaches. And it was just something I was like, huh, that's weird. Which, you know, as Sanka, I think, can attest, that a lot of times that's, you know, when you find yourself saying, huh, that's weird, that's when you're maybe about to see something that, or realize something that people haven't really realized before.
Sanka, you took a diving class as part of your school. When did you start making those sort of like scientific connections between what you were doing and what you were seeing?
So I was originally, and I think Steve really hit it on the head, in that it's hard to be an observant person in this world without fundamentally being a scientist. You know, I think as people, we're just drawn to the natural world, unless something actually pushes us away from it. And for me, what initially sort of began like a love affair with a particular group of animals that I still study now and then, was part of my family is Bosnian. And we went to the Croatian coast when I was about 15. We didn't scuba dive, but I spent the entire time under the water snorkeling and, you know, swimming around. The Adriatic was extremely clear. And under the rocks were all these different animals. They're called echinoderms, but we think, you know, one part of them are starfish, which, you know, people are pretty familiar with. But then there's also brittle stars, which look like starfish on serious weight loss plans, or you can think of them as five snakes stuck together at the head. And they move very, very quickly. And I remember turning a rock and seeing one for the first time. And at first I was horrified because I thought something terrible just happened and I was about to be stung. And then after that, I was utterly fascinated. But then when I went to graduate school, I knew I wanted to study these animals. And so my first time underwater for any length of time doing research was in the Florida Bay off of Long Key. And I was in very shallow water. And the wonderful thing about that is I could be in there all day and just look for all these different echinoderms, and I would study their behavior and how they responded to light. It was just this magical summer. I was out there for months, and every day I would just wake up, eat breakfast, and flop myself, you know, out into that water until it was time to eat dinner.
Do you remember your, Sanka, do you remember your first experience with bioluminescence?
Funny enough, it was actually flushing a toilet.
What?
Yeah, for real. So one of my first cruises was on a ship called the Oceanus out of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And the ship had saltwater toilets. Since most of the ships on, at least in the research fleet, use freshwater toilets, but these had saltwater. And they took water directly in from the ocean, you know, to be used. And if you turned out the lights in the bathroom, which I just done, you know, flipped off the light before I left, and I was like, oh, I got to flush the toilet. And then I flushed the toilet, and it looked like the beginning of Star Trek. You know, there's just these beautiful blue spinning circles of, you know, all these, you know, larger and smaller plankton, mostly small, just, well, rushing down the toilet hole.
I think to a lot of people, this feels like it must be a really rare thing. But Stephen, you were involved in a study that suggested this is actually very common among ocean life.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because we have such a, you know, obviously a human perspective on things. But in the ocean, we found all the way from the surface to 4,000 meters, which is, you know, like 13,000 feet deep, about 3/4 of the animals that we could see in our videos, in our sub videos, were bioluminescent. It was by far the rule. And I often say that, you know, it's much, much easier to list the things that don't have any bioluminescent members in the ocean than it is to list off all the things that do have bioluminescence, because there's really just a handful. And that handful is actually decreasing because we're still finding examples where a lineage, a type of animal that was thought not to have any bioluminescent species, we're finding more and more of them that do have some bioluminescence in them.
Sanka, you are on the East Coast. Stephen is on the West Coast. How did you guys meet?
Oh my God. I think we first met on a ship. We probably met on one of the ships that would go out of Florida when I was a postdoc, which is sort of a short sort of journeyman time after graduate school. And we both were connected to my postdoc advisor, Edith Witter, and ended up on the same ship. Steve, is that true? I think that's what we
Yeah, that sounds right. I mean, the only other time would have been at a conference, but I'm pretty sure we had a cruise together with Edie. And actually, I think I have a picture of you like romantically sitting on the back deck of the ship as we're leaving the port, looking, you know, your hero shot. But Edie is a kind of a formative figure in bioluminescence, and she had the same graduate advisor as I did. So she invited me on cruises right when I started grad school. I got to go on cruises with her, like, let's go to the Bahamas and do scuba diving and go down in a submarine and, you know, be on this ship with all the world experts on bioluminescence and jellyfish. And so I'm like, okay, sign me up. And, you know, then Sanka did his postdoc with her later. So we connected, and that must have been, I don't know, almost 30 years ago. We have complementary interests and I think abilities. And so it's fun to collaborate because we bring different perspectives to these same sets of issues.
At some point along the way, you guys looked at each other and you're like, we really need to do a photo book on light and color in the ocean. So when did you guys start geeking out about that potential idea?
It took a while. You know, like Steve said, you know, we have complementary interests. I come out of more of a math, physics, art background. He comes out of a very strong, you know, biology, naturalist engineering background. And as much as we sort of appreciated each other's knowledge, we didn't have a lot of common ground initially, except a love of being at sea and a love of the animals that were out there. But probably, I don't know, maybe after 5 or so years, we maybe 10, it could be longer, we would talk about the book. You know, at some point we need to write the book, you know, capital T, capital B, except we were happy to put it off. Because, you know, there was always something else, what a friend of mine called the tyranny of the immediate. You know, there's always something that gets in the way of having the book. And then this book came to us kind of like in a weird at last moment, like, you know, agree to do this right now or don't.
So one of the things that we both have been, you know, incredibly fortunate to see things that really no one else has been able to see just through our research, you know, collecting deep sea animals, taking them into the dark room in perfect condition, and then like saying, what do you have to show for yourself? We get to see things glow for the first time, flash, sparkle, you know, natural displays. And so just being able to share that and kind of counter the common way that the deep sea and the open ocean are presented, which is, you know, a trawled specimen that's kind of mangled, its jaws hanging off, or it was put in formalin for a couple of years and then taken back out for its photo shoot session. So just to try to share like a picture of what the ocean is really like and help people appreciate that it's not this, you know, ugly, scary, horrible, fanged environment. That's kind of been the underlying motivation for this. The other thing is that like everybody I know who studies jellyfish or these fragile deep sea creatures also is a photographer, because you can't just throw them in a jar and then think I'm going to go back and study this thing a couple of years later. You come back and your jar is just has some little whitish milky goo at the bottom of it. So there's no way to preserve a lot of these things that we're interested in. And so photography is really your way to capture them. And so through the years, we had just accumulated this big set of very unique photos because of our access to the animals and things that most people have not been able to see before. And so I think that combination made it compelling that we, you know, we really wanted to put it together into a book form to share.
You know, it's a funny thing because, you know, Steve and I are two of the, like you said, two of the few people that get to look at, you know, the ocean close up in its happy natural state. But this really is our planet. I mean, when you think about, you know, if some alien came to our planet, you know, and like looked around in our biosphere, like something over 90% of it is the deep ocean. I mean, we're an ocean planet. I mean, yeah, we sort of humans and other animals crawl around in a really narrow band on the land parts. And then, you know, there's coral reefs like wrapped up right against the coast. But the big deep ocean is like, you know, the habitat of our planet. And so getting that across to just sort of show, you know, this is our planet. This is what lives here. And, you know, they seem alien to us, but they're actually far more common than we are. And so, yeah, we just had this opportunity to show this. And we were two of the few people that could do that.
I mean, the other thing about this opportunity is that it originally came up when we were asked to kind of ghostwrite a book for photos that had been collected from stock photo agencies. And we said, well, we don't really want to do that, but we have this other book in mind that, you know, could potentially slot into that place in your lineup. And, you know, several of the photos that they had offered to us that they wanted us to work on were like computer generated. A lot of them were from dead specimens with, you know, milky white eyes, which is pretty typical. And to anyone who's seen an actual live deep sea animal, you immediately know that these are just fake, but so much of the content out there it's of that type, you know, they don't have the opportunity to get these photos. So they're like, yeah, we have these photos from award-winning photographers and we want you to like use them. And they were really skeptical that we would have photos that would be able to support, you know, a big coffee table type book. But when we started sending them batches of potential images, then they sort of like came around. And we also spun the focus more broadly than bioluminescence because we wanted to talk about iridescence and all these other beautiful ways that animals interact with light.
I think it could be hard for a lot of people to conceptualize the vastness of the ocean. Like one of the ways I've explained it is that the average terrestrial elevation above sea level across the globe is about 3,000 feet. And the ocean on average is four times that deep. And of course, it's much deeper at places. And it covers far more of our planet than our land does. There's just so much ocean out there. Most of it we haven't explored, which I gotta say, like, must make your work feel so potentiated with discovery at all times.
I mean, it's even worse than you describe because, yeah, okay, so the mountains get pretty tall and so on, but we still only live a little bit above the ground wherever they are and a little bit below. So it's like a rumpled surface. And so the ocean, of course, is much more than that. And you end up, like, depending on how you calculate it, somewhere between 90 and 99.5% of the Earth's space is ocean water. And what makes it worse is you usually can't see more than about 40 feet. You know, the water, even clear water, is an awful lot murkier than air. And so, you know, I can drive towards the North Carolina mountains and I see them when they're like, quite a distance away, tens of miles, maybe 100 miles away, depending on my elevation. But, you know, I've been, you know, less than a quarter mile off the entire island volcano of Hawaii, and you go underwater and you can't see it, even though, you know, it's right there and it's just one of the biggest mountains in the world. So, yeah, I mean, you're in a vast habitat that's completely featureless, but at the same time, you can't see much of it at a time. And so you never really know what's going to come around the corner, which can make driving around in an ROV or a submersible really fun, because it's not like you see something hundreds of feet away and you move up to it. It's just like things start to appear once they're within about 40 feet or so. And then you drive up and look at it close. So it's kind of addictive to drive around in the deep and see what's going to pop up, because you really don't know what it's going to be.
I think one of the things we also tried to do with the book is to give you a bit of perspective on how the animals that are operating in this environment, that it's in part us exploring it and the challenges there, but really for the animals, things could come at them from any direction. There's nothing to hide behind. But on the other hand, there's nothing to bump into, so they can grow to be large sizes. And it's usually pretty stable once you get below the surface. So there's all these different conditions and challenges and advantages that the organisms are experiencing, especially in the optical context. And so it was fun to try to like put yourself in the position of this animal. And these are your challenges. And how are you going to surmount them?
What are the questions that you guys still want to get down there and answer? What's picking at you?
I mean, for me, and this is a question I will probably never answer, but always comes up, is how on Earth, in such a huge habitat where almost every animal is extremely well camouflaged by being transparent or mirrored or whatever else, how do they find each other? Because we know they do find each other. I mean, one example I often give in talks is there's a beautiful transparent octopus. I mean, it looks like a living chandelier. And we know it mates. And we know that's how it reproduces. It physically gets together with another octopus and mates. I mean, we have video of it. But they are next to impossible to find. And how they find each other in a world, you know, in the darkness and with themselves already, you know, so transparent to begin with. And just this insane volume that they're working with. I mean, a lot of these animals are pretty rare. How they're doing it, how they're mating, basically, what does their social life look like is, I guess, the way I think about it, you know. And that, to me, is a question that I can't imagine I'll ever be able to answer, but would love to.
I think that's a great thing. One thing that's funny that is kind of like that is there's this barrel eye fish that, you know, is super rare and pretty spectacular. It was like on the Colbert Report, you know, it kind of went viral when we got some video of it. But we were looking at one of these, and then in the background was this other really rare squid that we hadn't seen. So we like looked over there, and there were two of them. And I haven't done the stats on it, but so often we'll see one really rare thing and there'll be another one of it kind of right next to it. Like they already did find each other and they're hanging out together. And so they've got to be having a lot of other things going on that we're not aware of. But like Sanka said, that's really mysterious. And kind of the epilogue of the book is that there are these other chemical cues, sound cues, you know, maybe even magnetic, or these hidden cues that we don't perceive as well as we perceive light, that have to be going on and that will be really interesting for future generations.
That's Stephen Haddock. He studies marine biology, marine diversity, and molecular biology at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Sanka Johnson has studied light in nature for more than 30 years, most recently at Duke University. Sanka, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Their new book is The Radiant Sea. Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, you can still listen to us every episode, wherever you get your podcasts. Public radio stations across the country have had substantial cuts to funding, so now more than ever, it's important to support this work if you are able. You can do that at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.